This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents See What Can Be Done, Essays, Criticism, and Commentary by Laurie Moore. This book is read by Bernadette Dunn. Introduction. The title of this book, See What Can Be Done, is not a boast, but an instruction. I received it with almost every note I got from Robert Silvers, editor of the New York Review of Books. He would propose I consider writing about something, he usually just FedExed a book to my door, and then he would offer a polite inquiry as to my interest. Perhaps I'd like to take a look at such and such. See what can be done, he would invariably close. My best, Bob. It was a magical request, and it suggested that one might like to surprise oneself. Perhaps a door would open up and you would step through it, though he would be the one to have put it there in the first place. Most of the pieces in this book are what could be done, at least by me, as I immersed myself in seeing what others could do. Cultural responses to cultural responses. However personal and idiosyncratic they are, the pieces by and large fall into the category of reviewing, although when a review gets long enough it may qualify as a critical essay, and when it is succinct enough it can be a remark. Remarks are not necessarily lesser. I believe Betty Davis should have won a Nobel Prize for Old Age is No Place for Sissies, a line Bob Dylan himself might covet. Essays, reviews, occasional meditations are all included here. Whether there is really a reason to round them all up, even selectively, is a question I can't answer. But I can say that I did the gathering because, looking at my decades-long life as a fiction writer, I noticed another trail had formed, a shadow life of miscellaneous prose pieces, and I wondered about it as a trip, if not precisely a journey. The pieces begin in 1983 in Cornell's literary magazine, Epoch, where I wrote reviews of books by Margaret Atwood and Nora Ephron, and they end in time for the golden anniversary of The Summer of Love, with a take on Stephen Stills. 34 years of, well, stuff. I mercifully have not included every last thing, though it may seem as if I have. In the late 1980s, when I was once introduced to a particular guest at a party, the guest said, "Oh yes, I know you. You review books." And my heart sank. After my debut collection of stories was published, Anatole Broyard, then a New York Times book review editor, was the first review commissioner to phone me at my office in Wisconsin and offer me work. Slightly terrified, I kept taking his assignments. "I think I've become Anatole Broyard's slave girl," I said to my then beau. "I don't know how to stop." And indeed, I probably wrote too many reviews, telling myself I needed the money. But a fiction writer reviewing is performing, I still believe, an essential task. Very few practicing artists review the work of their fellow sculptors or painters or dancers or composers, and so the conversation is left to non-practitioners. Although there are, of course, exceptions, and although the film directors of the French New Wave began as critics, and the sculptor Donald Judd wrote reviews of his peers, as did Schumann, Debussy, under a pseudonym, and Virgil Thompson, in general, the medium and the idiom of criticism do not belong to artists. One cannot really dance a review of someone else's dance. One cannot paint a review of someone else's exhibition. Criticism can be a rarefied field, but that aspect is usually galling to the artist, especially when the artist feels misunderstood and is reminded that critics have never attempted, let alone forge, the creative work that they, the critics, nonetheless feel emboldened to evaluate. In the words of the jazz musician Ben Sidran, "Critics can't even float. They just stand on the shore, wave at the boat." Or as Aristotle wrote in Politics, "Those who are to be judges must also be performers." Conversely, perhaps those who are performers must also be judges, once in a while. And so a contribution to the cultural conversation, by narrative artists themselves, Speaking in unmuddied, unacademic, unobfuscating, critical voices, I thought of as a difficult but obligatory citizenship, jury duty. One of the longest pieces here, coincidentally, is a defense of a jury. My own way of discussing the work of others, then, has been improvised and not grounded in any philosophy or theory other than lack of philosophy or theory. It has been, de facto, I assume, a practitioner's take. As for technique, I have always aimed for clarity of utterance and organization, but don't always succeed. I often move every which way in attempting to track my own thoughts about someone else's endeavor. Sometimes I inappropriately include my own life in the conversation to show how narrative art intrudes, fits, or does not fit into the daily lives of those who are experiencing it. I have aimed for the human, but also for the eccentricities and particularities of the real encounter, and I do not always avoid stupidities. Sometimes I head for stupidities in order to discuss them, even if they are my own. Often a piece is constructed in a circular fashion, like a cat clearing a space before it naps. Other times I veer. I sometimes try to pull back as much as I can to look at something from a distance without losing my balance. I then also try to move forward again and bear down. When in 1999 I began writing for the New York Review of Books, which published articles by people much better educated than I, but which also offered me more space than I was used to, my stance became that of the ingenuous Martian who had just landed on a gorgeous alien planet. With no agenda and only the usual amounts of research, I said, "What's this?" I tried to figure out what feelings the piece contained, what it made the reader feel, what that said about our world and our lives and the feelings we value. I aimed for simple, I aspired to deceptively simple, and true. I aimed for bravery of opinion, though I am not by temperament especially brave. But I admire iconoclasm, if it is not too breezy or gratuitous. If what the emperor was wearing was a mixed bag, I tried to indicate as much. I also tried to figure out what the emperor had in mind, even if one is not supposed to guess at intention. I have tried to avoid petulance, internet ease, literary theory, the diction and dialect of the professionally educated critic, and never to use the word relatable instead of sympathetic or impact as a verb or any form of the word enjoy, which should be reserved for one's grandparents or other relatives. I tried not to drag readers by the scruff of the neck and march them from paragraph to paragraph, point by point, but did not always succeed. I allowed myself asides and tangents and personal anecdotes because circumnavigating a thing, the napping cat again, patrolling for snakes, is sometimes a useful approach. First-person assessments engage me. Dorothy Parker's reviews were full of them, so she could employ her rapier with faux reluctance, and often the use of the first person is not arrogant, but modest, hedged, and more accurate. One does not always have to write in the authoritative third-person voice of God. If you fail to sound like God, and you probably will, you may end up sounding like flap copy. The first-person pronoun can be a form of deference and is useful and precise when discussing the subjectivity and crowded detail of narrative art. It suggests one specific encounter paid close attention to. It appreciates the intersection of one individual reader's life with the thing that has been read. It breathes air into the conversation, or can. It reveals criticism to be a form of autobiography. When someone once said to me, "Your pieces in the New York Review of Books are the only ones I can actually understand," I knew it wasn't praise. The speaker's real subject was the difficult brilliance and impressive erudition of the other critics he admired there. Nonetheless, I decided to take it as a compliment. One has to seize encouragement where one can. Someone once also told me early on that there was a well-known list of 6 things a book review should always do. This caused me to break out in a cold sweat. I politely asked for the list, but it was never given to me, nor did I ever find it anywhere. So I carried on, without knowledge of official requirements. And to this day, I still don't know what those 6 things are. I began writing about television by accident. I did not watch much television as an adult and had not watched much as a child, having grown up in a house where the watching of it was discouraged and highly supervised. We read the Bible every night at the dinner table, and in general, television was considered a little wicked and lazy and for special occasions, like eggnog. But in 2010, after The Wire was already out on DVD, I watched the series on a binge, also like eggnog, living in David Simon's Baltimore for an entire summer. And afterward, intoxicated and wanting to extend my experience there by reading what other people had to say, one terrific function of cultural criticism is a kind of afterlife of the original encounter, I could not find very much written about it. The London papers had some articles, but there was very little in the American press, nothing in the New Yorker, and what seemed like minimal coverage in the New York Times. I asked Bob Silvers if he would like something for the New York Review of Books, and he quickly said yes. His sensibility was always spry, eager, open, a source of joy for everyone who worked for him. He was so hiply Catholic in his tastes and interests that he was game for practically any kind of cultural commentary, meditations on regional politics, reports on every manner of book, television series, film, or event. Gameness is a beautiful quality in a person. My ignorance of a topic never deterred him from trying to assign it to me. He started offering more and more television for me to watch and see what could be done. I turned only a few things down, but I took on programs and films I was genuinely interested in watching and wrote about them in my Martian way. Montaigne's Qu'est-ce? A little light, a little wonder, some skepticism, some awe, some squinting, some je ne sais quoi. Pick a thing up. Study it. Shake it. Skip it across a still surface to see how much felt and lively life got baked into it. Does it sail? Observe. See what can be done. L.M. Nora Ephron's Heartburn. Nora Ephron, whose name sounds like a neurotransmitter or a sinus medication, and who has made a reputation for herself with snappy journalistic essays, is now, with the publication of Heartburn, a novelist with a vengeance. While much has already been made of the book's thinly veiled relationship to the real-life demise of Ephron's marriage to investigative reporter Carl Bernstein, Heartburn is interesting less for its Romana Clay minutiae than as a text-as-test look at how and whether autobiographical art can function as therapy. What can art expurgate? What will art necessarily sentimentalize? From what can art never rescue anyone? Ephron's narrative itself seems unclear as to whether the literary telling of one's injuries is exorcism, revenge, or masochism. It takes 2 people to hurt you, says Ephron's narrator and protagonist, Rachel Samstadt, the one that does it and the one who tells you. It is a remark that glimpses her own narrative dilemma. When the teller is both casualty and curator of her own bad news, might not the so-called cathartic narrative be, finally, an act of self-mutilation, a redundant pain? Do we, as Joan Didion says, tell ourselves stories in order to live, or is there something decidedly else involved? The artist in Ephron's novel is metaphorized into cookbook writer. Rachel Samstadt, 7 months pregnant and mother of one, retreats into Cuisinarts, linguine, and TV cooking shows, while her husband, Mark Feldman, a Washington, D.C. columnist, quietly falls in love with the wife of an ambassador, all within the townhouses of our nation's capital. It's stuff like this that got us into Cambodia, says Rachel. The novel begins when Rachel first discovers Mark's affair and ends a few weeks later when she finally lets go of her marriage, surrendering to her husband her beloved vinaigrette recipe, which she'd previously been withholding in a last-ditch effort at keeping him interested. Food, in Rachel's world, is power and downfall, hobby and social fabric. Recipes can fend off unpleasantries. She recalls the 60s as being a time when people were always looking up and asking, "Whose moose is this?" She deems the definitive pronouncement of the years following as, "Pesto is the quiche of the 70s. Rachel's society is self-consciously bourgeois. We would all say these things as if we had never said them before, and argue over them as if we had never argued over them before. Then we would all decide whether we wanted to be buried or cremated." Hers is a vaguely jet-set-ish world of talk show therapists, celebrity dinner parties, large American Express bills, expensive country homes. Materialism battles uninvited poetry, unwelcome neurasthenia. "Show me a woman who cries when the trees lose their leaves in autumn," says Rachel, "and I'll show you a real asshole." The success of Efren's novel as art depends in some ways on its ineffectuality as revenge. Her generous inability to present a wholly unlikable portrait of Mark. He courts Rachel charmingly, sings her silly songs, lovingly talks her through two cesareans, genuinely stirs the reader, although it betrays Efren's continuing affection for the figure of the husband, permanently sentimentalizing a man who does not seem to have earned the bittersweet clemency much of the portrait grants him. Nonetheless, his character weathers even the novel's bitchiest moments because of it. Rachel exacts no satisfaction from this tale. At the end, she seems her own victim, alone, unavenged, scarred by the untimely rips in her body and in her life. As anyone who has ever eaten standing over a kitchen counter knows, cooking can be an act of excruciatingly delayed gratification. Things must be chopped, stewed, simmered, and the impulse that prompted it all can dissipate in the culinary shuffle. Efren's heartburn, like many acts of literary retaliation, has taken too much time and craft to be a potent swipe at anyone. Artful preparation has mellowed and sweetened the ingredients. It is less revenge than revision, less actively asserted rancor than retroactively inserted wit. Though Rachel says to her therapist, "If I tell the story, it doesn't hurt as much," and "If I tell the story, I can get on with it," the story makes the reader feel too sorry for her to believe that telling it has done her any good at all. Efren's nostalgia and revenge are simply different forms of one another. The sad deliciousness of concoction, even served with the best Efren wine, seems more a miserable monument to sorrow than anything that could vanquish the muck of the real. Catharsis is nowhere to be glimpsed, which is how art should be. 1983. Kurt Vonnegut's Galapagos. Yes, American culture is more smart than wise. But Kurt Vonnegut, that clown poet of homesickness and Armageddon, might be the rare American writer who is both. He dances the witty and informed dances of the literary smart, but while he does, he casts a wide eye about, and he sees. He is a postmodern Mark Twain, grumpy and sentimental, antic and religious. He is that paradoxical guy who goes to church both to pray fervently and to blow loud, snappy gum bubbles at the choir. Galapagos, Vonnegut's new novel, boasts the energies and daring do of his earlier works. It is the story, sort of a second Noah's Ark, a 1986 nature cruise booked with celebrities, Mick Jagger, Paloma Picasso, Jacqueline Onassis, and others, that in the wake of planetary catastrophe, famine, financial crises, World War III, and a virus that eats the eggs in human ovaries, is fated to land on the Galapagos Islands and perpetuate the human race. Humanity was about to be diminished to a tiny point by luck, and then, again by luck, to be permitted to expand again. All this may sound like a glittery and Darwinian Gilligan's Island, not really what Galapagos is at all, although certainly the novel has something to do with the giant crush America has on celebrity. The famous people never really do make it into the story, and what we end up with is a madcap genealogical adventure, a blend of the Old Testament, the Latin American novel, and a lot of cut-up comic books, employing a cast of lesser-knowns that includes a schoolteacher named Mary Hepburn, an Ecuadorian sea captain named Von Kleist, a former male prostitute named James Waite, whose skin color is like the crust on a pie in a cheap cafeteria. A dog named Kazakh, who, thanks to surgery and training, had virtually no personality, plus a narrator who turns out to be none other than the son of Kilgore Trout, that science fiction hack from Vonnegut's earlier books. Leon Trout, Vonnegut's doppelganger, speaks to us, moreover, from a million years hence, from the afterlife, whence he can best pronounce on what was wrong with us 20th century folk. Our brains were too big, and reveal what, through evolution and for purposes of survival, we became. Creatures with smaller brains and flippers and beaks. Even if people of the future found a grenade or a machine gun or a knife or whatever left over from olden times, how could they ever make use of it with just their flippers and their mouths? Leon Trout asks. And it is hard to imagine anybody's torturing anybody nowadays. How could you even capture somebody you wanted to torture with just your flippers and your mouth? Vonnegut has probably always been a better teller than maker of stories. One continually marvels at the spare, unmuddied jazz of a Vonnegut sentence and too often despairs of his ramshackle plots. Galapagos is, typically and perhaps aptly, structured spatially, like an archipelago. Tiny islands of prose detached from that apparently dangerous continent of time. Childhood reminiscences, parables, interviews, real and invented history, nature writing, sapient literary quotations, a soldier's confession. The literary novel, alas, has always lacked a natural form. This is a narrative style engendered by emergency, the need to get directly to something. It is susceptible, however, to an unhelpful chaos and can defeat its own purpose by blithely wandering off and turning whole chapters into scrapbooks of blather and dead end. But Vonnegut seems eventually to get where he wants, shining his multicolored lights and science fiction what-ifs on the huge spiritual mistake that is the Western world. He wants to tell us things. It is not the fittest who survive. It is merely those who happen to survive who survive. The Earth is a fragile habitat that our big brains have failed to take care of. We must hope for flippers and beaks, or nothing at all. We are all, finally, being too mean to one another. I'll tell you what the human soul is, a character in Galapagos says. It's the part of you that knows when your brain isn't working right. Although not as moving as, say, Slaughterhouse-Five, Galapagos does have moments of father-son vis-a-vis that bring a glug to the throat. And although more wobblingly cobbled and arrhythmic comically than Breakfast of Champions, Galapagos can be as darkly funny. Vonnegut asterisks the names of characters who are going to die and, after their inevitably gruesome deaths, kisses them off with the elegiac, "Oh, well. He wasn't going to write Beethoven's Ninth Symphony anyway." Early in the novel, he even puts Captain von Kleist on The Tonight Show, and what follow are the best laughs in the book. Vonnegut's work long ago broke ground for such writers as Richard Brautigan, Thomas Pynchon, Donald Bartlemy, Tom Robbins, all curators of the rhetorical and cultural non sequitur. But Vonnegut's grumbly and idiomatic voice has always been his own, unfakeable and childlike, and his humanity, persisting as it does through his pessimism, is astonishing, seeming at times more science fiction than his science fiction. As for his suspended concern for the well-made big-brained novel, Vonnegut has opted to zoom in directly for the catch, the idea, the oracular bit. His books are not only like canaries in coal mines, his own analogy, but like the cormorants of the Galapagos Islands, who, in their idiosyncratic evolution, have sacrificed flight for the getting of fish. 1985. Malcolm Bradbury's Cuts. Henry Babbicome, the writer protagonist of Malcolm Bradbury's new novel Cuts, has no need to search for El Dorado. It has come looking for him. El Dorado is a British television company aiming to ensure its solvency and future with a blockbuster mini-series, accented perhaps on the second syllable to rhyme with miseries. In its previous effort, Gladstone, Man of Empire, El Dorado lost its leading man, a famous and venerated old actor, when he was required to appear before the character of Queen Victoria in the nude and playing the ukulele. It was fictionalized verity, explained the El Dorado head of drama, plays, and series. You take real people and events, but you're not slavishly bound to actual facts. In such fiscally tight times, El Dorado Television can afford no more ukuleles. It wants a drama with love and power and tenderness and glory, and a lot of mountains in the background. It wants love and power, past and present, tears and laughter. It wants love and feeling, ancient buildings and contemporary problems. It wants contemporary reality, strong hero, elegant locations. It wants something that's art but is also life at its deepest and most telling. It wants a lush foreign location where you can get malt whiskey. It wants epic. It wants tragic. It wants cheap. In a quaint and decorous moment, El Dorado decides it also wants a writer, someone brilliant and postmodern with a decidedly bushel-hidden light, someone with a rumbling stomach. That week, it so happens, Henry Babbicome's agent is sleeping with an El Dorado executive, and it is suggested that El Dorado give Babbicome a try. As for Babbicome, he desires no such thing. He lives contentedly and alone in a tiny northern hill village where he teaches evening classes called Sex and Maturity in the English Novel and the somewhat more popular Fiction and the Farm. During the day, he writes obscure Beckettian novels in the garden shed of his backyard. His workday includes the consumption of high-fiber cereal, the writing down of his dreams, and at 6 o'clock, the preparation of a simple salad. If he feels isolated and in need of cultural diversion, he whistles, usually something classical. When he is summoned to the glass high-rise of El Dorado Television, he is baffled, but he goes, bringing with him on the train a pile of student essays on Middlemarch. After that, circumstances conspire to urge Babbicome into accepting El Dorado's offer. He is more wined than dined at a long lunch where every course is served with kiwi fruit, including a scarlet rack of lamb and a gorgonzola pâté, laid out so beautifully it was a pity to disturb it, as indeed it proved. When he returns to his provincial university to discuss with the head of his department the possibility of a leave of absence, Babbicome is given a grim speech about university financial problems. Already the college has had to rely on private endowments in an unprecedented manner, as in the Kingsley Amish Chair of Women's Studies. The chairman, whose problems before the cuts had always been either of fornication or of plagiarism, is now obliged to get rid of 2 staff members. He has already resorted to sending colleagues out on dangerous errands in the hope that they will be run over by buses. As dedicated a man as the French structuralist, who named his daughters Long and Parole, has already left. A Shakespearean professor has retrained as an airline pilot. Henry Babbicombe has given his chairman the perfect opportunity. The chairman must consider the impact of crass television work on the reputation of his faculty. The chairman himself would never dream of hiring out his mind for vulgar profit. In fact, his department has generally refused even to publish books, naturally preferring to transfer their thoughts by word of mouth to the two or three people who are fit to understand them. Envy and budget cuts team up, and Babbicombe is fired from his academic Eden, his life of quiet eccentricity and bold indifference to reality, his world of sooty Gothic buildings papered with announcements of essay competitions on whether there should be a third sex. He is plunged instead into the dark farce of a scriptwriting career. What ensues is riotous, if predictable, misadventure. In the world of script collaboration, Babbicombe is the prototypical literary naïve, a country cousin, sans fec, sans hap, sans hope. Without his knowledge or consent, the setting of the series switches continents weekly. El Dorado personnel begin the rewrites before Babbicombe has finished the rights. El Dorado titles Babbicombe's script Serious Damage. And truly, it is that. His literary ambitions in abeyance, Babbicombe, wooed with kiwi fruit, becomes a kind of emissary of his own incapacitated self, a venturer, if not adventurer, into the heartless illogic of commercial television. It is a world that believes all problems are problems of notional casting. It is a world in which an obscure Beckettian novelist is asked to work up a totally spurious death scene and does so, setting a new standard in rigor mortis. To add injury to insult, the urban landscape Babbicombe encounters is one wrought by privation, privatization, moral calamity. Lovemaking is staccato and short. It was wise not to touch someone who might have touched someone else, who in turn had touched someone else. Sex was being replaced by gender. And tenderness is pruned to tender wedges and slivers of the diminishing national pie. Says the omniscient narrator of Cuts, the only pleasure left to make life worth living, if it was at all, was money. Poor little paper money, which was trying to do all the work. Malcolm Bradbury is the author of an impressive array of critical works, including books on Evelyn Waugh and Saul Bellow, and of the novels The History Man and Rates of Exchange. What he has given us in Cuts is once more a depiction of man as historical performer, this time in a satirical romp through Thatcher England. It was a time for getting rid of the old, soft illusions and replacing them with the new, hard illusions. Bradbury has milked his title for all it is worth, and it is worth much. If he has left us feeling a bit severed at the end, it may have been one cut too many, but we get the authorial joke. There is so much fun, fury, and intelligence in this little novel, one can forgive its insistent cartoonishness, or those rare moments when the wit is less rapier than spoon. If the insidious world of television as literary subject or sociological context manages by its very nature to preclude the writing of great literature, that would be this modest book's point. Bradbury has succeeded in doing what the social satirist must do, to amuse trenchantly, leaving in the throat a strange taste, rather like a rancid kiwi fruit. 1987. Anais Nin, Marilyn Monroe. In the love lives of the famous, romance is largely a public business. Private affairs made public, public affairs made even more public. And at the bedroom doors of all those affairs lurk, inevitably, the writers, biographers, journalists, novelists, poets, diarists, intent on giving public shape to private muck, heedless of the wishes of the muckers or muckies. Occasionally this makes for daring and probing books, But more often, it produces the literary equivalent of McDonald's. Private passions, some long dead, are unearthed and reworked into public French fries. Two recent books, Aid and Abet, to varying degrees, this sort of literary cannibalism. Both fairly slim volumes they describe to very different couples. Anais Nin and Henry Miller, and Joe DiMaggio and Marilyn Monroe. In the first, we are given what is indeed a probing and daring book, a passionate diary account from the interior of the affair. In the latter, we get fast food, a newspaperman's best guesses from Outer Mongolia. When Anais Nin, at age 63, published the first volume of her already notorious diary in 1966, she excised an important chunk of the journal and of her own personal history. In its edited form, the diary was a mesmerizing collage that included opinions on interior decorating, lyrical self-attacks, and compassionate psychosexual analyses of her friendships with some of the bohemians and bourgeoisie of 30s Paris. Nin had already begun writing a diary as a young girl, conceiving it as a means of talking to her absent father, a celebrated violinist who had abandoned the family when Anais was 9. As one might expect, there is everywhere in her diary a search and hunger for father figures, attended by conflicting desires to seduce, retrieve, vanquish, and be loved by them. The part of her journal that was originally deleted detailed some of the fruits of that search. Nin's discovery at the age of 28 of two father figures, in the persons of writer Henry Miller, then 40, and his enigmatic wife, June. What resulted was something of a ménage à trois, a crush on June, and a full-blown adulterous affair with Henry. Nin was also married at the time. For Nin, her relationship with the Millers was a laboratory of the soul, a dangerous theater of self, and the diary served as a kind of dressing room to which she repaired. It is only now, 9 years after Nin's death, that her publisher and her executor have seen fit to publish what she wrote. They have titled it Henry and June, from the unexpurgated diary of Anais Nin. There is this to be said for expurgation and elision. It can be a writer's most effective tool. Put back in what the writer herself took out, and the work's edges may get lost, the essence clouded. Unexpurgated, Nin says of Henry Miller things like, "He looks down and shows me his lanced desire again," or, "Yesterday, in the very paroxysm of sensual joy, I could not bite Henry as he wanted me to." Whereas in the edited volume, Nin is deftly attuned to the people around her, in Henry and June, she is made to appear in a hormonal haze, erotically preoccupied, tortured by a question that seems to nag only women in their 20s. Is what I'm calling love really just good sex? And its heartbreaking corollary, is what I'm calling good sex not even all that good? Nin wears black underwear. This is not the stuff of heavy philosophical inquiry. Nonetheless, Nin knew all about beauty and sexual game playing, and she wrote about it with a poetry and intelligence that can pass for profundity. Her sensitivity to the physical and emotional was such that virtually everything in her life, from meals to hand-holding, became an aesthetic moment. "There are two ways to reach me," Nin wrote in December 1931, soon after meeting the Millers. "By way of kisses or by way of the imagination?" June Miller reached her via the latter and Henry via the former. Nin's relationship with June was by and large one of mutual infatuation, and it expressed itself in intense conversations, walks, gifts of perfume, stockings, jewelry. And although Nin had recurrent dreams in which June had a small secret penis, surely somebody is rolling in a grave somewhere, their desire for each other seems to have remained delicate and unconsummated. "Our love would be death," The Embrace of Imaginings, Nin wrote. When in early 1932 June left Paris for New York and a lesbian lover she claimed to have there, it was Henry, 12 years Nin's senior, with whom Nin became sexually involved. Henry, with whom she experienced the white heat of living. "I'll teach you new things," he said. And a few weeks later, Nin wrote in her diary, "It is easy to love, and there are so many ways to do it." Perhaps like no two other writers of their time, Nin and Miller were interested in erotic appetites. "For once," wrote Nin, "I stand before a nature more complicated than my own." Indeed, the pairing of Nin and Miller seemed something like the Ollie Fraser match of literary sex. When they weren't checking into hotels together at noon, and sometimes even when they were, they read each other's manuscripts, discussed their interests in Lawrence and Dostoevsky, wrote at enormous amorous length to and about each other. Miller's words were explosive, exhausting. Nin's were searching and metaphorical, attempting to grasp with poetry what she felt his realism could not capture. "My work is the wife of his work," she wrote. Although Nin claimed to have grown enormously in this period, her fiery passion for Miller eventually subsided. She felt an increased tenderness toward her banker husband, Hugo, a man who is shown in Henry and June to be Nin's real anchor, someone who provided her with a suburban home, a monthly allowance, and a famous psychoanalyst, with whom she also had an affair. True bohemianism gave her cold feet. Miller's worn lapels and jacket cuffs pained her, as did his terrible eyesight, made weak by his job as a newspaper proofreader. She grew discomforted by Miller's sponging of her money and by his spending it on prostitutes. Once when Nin brought Miller an elegant breakfast on a tray, all he could say was that he longed for the bistro around the corner, the zinc counter, the dull greenish coffee, and milk full of skin. By the end, Nin had discovered the perverse boy at the core of the man, had exposed Miller's emotional and financial helplessness and his petty cruelty. She had conquered a father figure, but no longer quite believed in him. When the affair was over, after less than a year, she wrote movingly, "Last night I wept. I wept because I was no longer a child with a blind girl's faith. I wept because I could not believe anymore. And I love to believe." The very public and glamorous love shared by Marilyn Monroe and her second husband, retired Yankee star Joe DiMaggio, might have seemed, unlike the private adultery of Miller and Nin, fated to be happy. But it was patently not happy, and since neither Monroe nor DiMaggio kept passionate diaries, few people have been privy to the intimate reasons for the failure of their marriage. The most recent, in an endless stream of biographies, Joe and Marilyn, A Memory of Love, does little to remedy that state of affairs. The biggest problem with this book is that it's simply not long on material. Monroe and DiMaggio's marriage lasted all of 9 months, and DiMaggio, who is still alive, has refused to talk about Monroe with anyone, including author Roger Kahn. So Kahn has to do some rhetorical tap dancing. When, in Joe and Marilyn, Kahn runs out of things to say about the lives of Mr. and Mrs. America, as Monroe and DiMaggio were dubbed by the press, he shamelessly summarizes movie plots, lectures on sexual mores, extemporizes on batting streaks. Every once in a while, under the strain of improvisation, he simply throws up his hands and attempts one-sentence paragraphs like, "What a hard, sad life." Unlike Nin and Miller, DiMaggio and Monroe both enjoyed and paid heavily for quick rises to stardom from deprived backgrounds. He from poor Sicilian parents, she from a series of foster homes and a Los Angeles orphanage. When they met, each was aroused by the other's fame, but also by some mistaken impression that they were kindred spirits. Each sought comfort in the homey fantasies they entertained about the other. For Monroe, DiMaggio was protective, courteous, fatherly. For DiMaggio, Monroe was the sexiest housewife in America. What Monroe got was an average Joe who liked to sit in front of the television watching sports all day. What DiMaggio got, among other things, was a woman who rarely ironed. In his prime, DiMaggio was accomplished and revered, given to an old-fashioned reserve that may or may not have hidden a more turbulent nature, depending on to whom one listens. Monroe, by contrast, was an exhibitionistic and unfocused talent, denigrated by the very Hollywood that had made her a star. But Monroe wasn't stupid. As Kahn points out, she collected sophisticated books and displayed a sexy, impudent wit. Once, when asked what she had on during a photography session, Monroe replied, "The radio." About her husband, she used to say, "Joe brings a great bat into the bedroom." The latter example, writes Kahn, suggests why the couple broke up. Their relationship was an overridingly physical one, with Monroe chafing under what she felt to be the marriage's intellectual constraints, and DiMaggio growing less comfortable with Monroe's hugely public sexuality, something that she called a career. Kahn insists, however, that DiMaggio's love for Monroe continued long after their marriage, that it was a lapping, ceaseless flame, that he attempted to protect her from Hollywood phonies and overweening psychiatric wards. Nonetheless, Monroe's losing battle with mental illness has become Hollywood legend, and DiMaggio's something of an ineffectual knight-errant within that legend. "Joe DiMaggio strikes out," read newspaper headlines when he and Monroe announced the end of their brief marriage. Kahn, speculating from the periphery, cannot hope to have put together a book that is much more than sympathetically rendered hearsay. And books such as his, unlike the rich personal document of Henry and June, are more evidence, if any were needed, of the cruel triviality and petty theft inherent in most celebrity biography. As a journalist, Kahn is only at the perimeter of his subject and must take up the role of voyeur. He writes, "We know that when she killed herself on August 4, 1962, Marilyn needed a pedicure." Is that what we want to know? Ghoulishly enough, as we watch Joe DiMaggio sell coffee makers on TV, and we wonder still about the men who married Marilyn Monroe, maybe the answer is yes? 1987. John Cheever. Literature, when it is occurring, is the correspondence of two agoraphobics. It is lonely and waited for, brilliant and pure and frightened, a marriage of birds, a conversation of the blind. When biography intrudes upon this act between reader and author, it may do so in the smallest of vehicles. Photographs, book jacket copy, rumors, parked quietly outside. In its more researched and critical form, the biography, it may nose into the house proper. Probably it is difficult for biography not to intrude at all, for the impulse toward it, in its insistence and irresistibility, resembles something more physical than intellectual. The housebound correspondents wonder and invent and begin to make a being of the other behind the letters. So innocently insinuating is the biographical that even the professional biographer may begin a work entitled John Cheever with the words, "This book is for Vivian," momentarily allowing his own biography to occlude his subjects in a pretty if irrelevant cameo. Such is the religious nature of the biographical that it believes all work must come from some place that one can give it, dedicate it like a prayer. Whatever its seductive impingements, in literature, biography is never the point. In biography's attempts to know the exact midwifery between life and art, it is always guessing. With its power to eclipse and compete, its attempts to own and undo mystery, it remains, as Twain once said, the mere clothes and buttons of the man. And it is an odd paradox that every such biographer must know this deeply, and also deeply not know it. real life, that collection of facts with an angle thrown in, has the importunate growl of stomach or wolf. It raps compellingly at all doors, including those behind which is conducted the preferential code of poetry and fiction. Literary biography has boasted some of the finest and bravest practitioners, from Boswell on Johnson to Gaskell on Bronte. Yet there is always something a little guilty in it, whatever its pleasures for the reader. For the subject, biography is a kind of artistic tax, winging in during life like a complicated pamphlet, after death like a crow. At least Scott Donaldson's new biography of John Cheever, the first to appear since Cheever's death in 1982, is not a lurid act of forensic medicine or necrophilia. Though it has none of the genius of its subject, it imitates honorably Cheever's politeness, intelligence, and reserve, hobbled in its significance, perhaps, by the appearance in 1984 of Susan Cheever's memoir, Home Before Dark, and the forthcoming Cheever Letters. Donaldson's biography manages, nonetheless, with sweat on its modest brow, to gather Cheever's life into a kind of mad English garden of data, through which lovers of Cheever's fiction may not be able to resist a stroll. "Writing is very much like a kiss," said Cheever, thinking of those readers. "It is something you can't do alone." It is a remark that both denies and illustrates the solitude of a literary life, and it is a telling one. John Cheever, a biography, though populated with the names of Cheever's colleagues, intimates, and admirers, seems primarily the story of a man who found himself alone in a way he could never quite accept, in a way that took him completely against his will. Cheever grew up in Quincy, Massachusetts, the son of a failed shoe salesman and a stern Englishwoman whose entrepreneurial instincts were sounder than her spouse's. She came to own a successful gift shop. Like F. Scott Fitzgerald, whose life and work Cheever's most resemble, Cheever lived in the best neighborhood in town, but with an imposter sensitivity and insecurities, due in part to the failure of his father. Both Cheever and Fitzgerald had strong, autonomous mothers, and in their adult life, each felt the desire to shore up the masculine side of himself in fear of the strength of the feminine. They both lived very socially, forging new, more secure identities out of their abilities to charm and impress the rich, towing the ragged line between court jester and town clown. Cheever with more grace, perhaps, but both with a powerful, liquored ambivalence. Donaldson suggests that Cheever's talent came from his mother's side of the family, which was educated and artistic. But it was his father's side that Cheever himself tended to mythologize, with its somewhat spurious links to Ezekiel Cheever, the legendary 17th century schoolmaster at the Boston Latin School. It was also Cheever's father who, while working full-time in a shoe factory, had once studied evenings to be a magician, one of his handbook tricks being how to cook an omelet in your hat. Surely a significant bit in a writer's parentage. Cheever, sly, plump, and only an average student whose spelling, according to one teacher, was unusual to say the least, learned early the power of good storytelling, which he was encouraged to do in front of his classmates, and of excellent manners. As a mere kindergartner, he was remembered as having been the only child who, upon leaving a party, spoke to the hostess. "Thank you for inviting me," he said. "I enjoyed it very much, and I mean it." At Thayer Academy at the age of 13, he wrote astonishingly sophisticated poetry. He composed the winning slogan for Good Posture Week, "Make it Posture Week, not Weak Posture." And when, in 1930, at the age of 17, he was expelled for poor grades, he sat down and wrote a story titled Expelled, sent it off to Malcolm Cowley at the New Republic, and had it accepted for publication. Out of rejection was launched his brilliant career. It is a story such as Expelled, the portrait of a prep school to which the young narrator has not been allowed to return, that no doubt causes Donaldson to use straightforward summaries of Cheever's fiction as mortar, and sometimes as the bricks themselves, in reconstructing Cheever's youth and young adulthood. Donaldson himself tells of Cheever's allergy to the unembroidered truth, so one can hardly believe that art and life serve each other well here. The trompe-l'oeil of autobiography present in any fiction is difficult enough, but the presumption of it, foisted on Cheever's work, makes for a semblance of biographical desperation. But it is not as if Donaldson hasn't done his research. He guides the reader through a detailed chronology. Cheever's move to New York in 1934, the trips to Yaddo, the marriage to Mary Winternitz, the military service at an army camp that looks like, of all places, Harvard, the Guggenheim Fellowships, the National Book Award for 1957, the journeys to Italy, the house in Ossining. Donald is fine, if careful, in his presentation of Cheever's long and finally turbulent relationship with the New Yorker. He is vivid, if short-winded, in his discussion of Cheever's deep attachment to his brother Fred, a relationship Cheever felt stirred the homosexual longings in him. He goes into great anecdotal detail about servants the Cheevers had, both in Italy and on the Vanderlip estate in Scarborough, New York, where they rented for some years. And he is strangely, if respectfully, tight-lipped regarding Cheever's wife, Mary, who never emerges very clearly, and to whom the biography, at times, does seem beholden. It is not until the book's last third that the picture of Cheever that Donaldson is after sharpens into something wrenching. By middle age, Cheever's heavy drinking had affected his work habits and made chaos of his family life. Bisexuality seemed at first to offer the connection and emotion that he felt had eluded him despite all his gifts. Promiscuity ripped open a room in him. He had affairs with students, with men in gay baths, and more notoriously, with Ned Roram and with Hope Lang. At Boston University, he was hired to teach the same year that Anne Sexton, also a faculty member, committed suicide. Cheever himself sank into a depression exacerbated by drinking. In the middle of the second semester, he was sent home to his wife, and John Updike was brought in to take over the class. By the end of his life, Cheever had won his battle against alcoholism, but to some, it seemed too late. "At your age," the poet Hayden Carruth told him, "I think I'd have gone out loaded." "Puking all over someone else's furniture?" Cheever replied. He had salvaged his life in time to write two more novels, Falconer and Oh, What a Paradise It Seems, and to see his collected stories win the Pulitzer Prize in 1978. He felt a renewal of affection toward Ossining, took up bicycling, left parties early. And it was then, at the age of 69, that he fell victim to the perverse timing of disease and was diagnosed as having the cancer that would, a year later, kill him. Fitzgerald was the only writer that Cheever ever chose to write about. In a short biography for Atlantic Brief Lives in 1971, and Donaldson, who has also written biographies of Fitzgerald and Hemingway, tells us, "There is no disputing the fact that in composing his brief life of Fitzgerald, Cheever was writing about himself." Cheever's life, however, seems finally a more ordinary and more heartbreaking one than Fitzgerald's. As Wilfred Sheed once remarked, "Cheever reminds one of the old story about the patient with the bed next to the window who invented a gaudy world outside to please the other patients, although his window overlooked a bank wall." One suspects, even feels, Cheever's intimacy with that wall. Trapped in the alcoholic purchase of oblivion and euphoria, residing within a marital carcass to which he claimed only formal loyalty, hoping somehow to allay the lovelessness he had felt for mother and wife, both women named Mary, Cheever constructed a life of beautiful speech, a voice blended with English and Yankee accents, a prose of ecclesiastical tones, of sadness and lyrical affirmation. So elegant were his spoken sentences that people not looking often thought he was reading. He was at once a toothless Thurber, a wicked satirist, and the Chekhov of Westchester. In his work and spirit, there was a struggle and division between the celebratory and the deprecatory. When he was elected